I'm going to turn you first to Luke's Gospel, chapter 21. There's a reason for this. Matthew 24 and 25 are a section of Scripture that holds together. It is one. It is simply one. He's speaking in answer to the disciples' question, which we'll look at in a moment, but the answer to the question is then unfolded in a great explanation of things to come in the future. It's a prophecy. And it goes into prophecy, and then it goes into what I would call exhortation. And I suppose encouragement to be ready for his return. And it leads right on at the end of chapter 25 to the final judgment seat of Christ. Now, I've opened you to Luke 21 because Luke 21 actually puts things a little clearer on a number of the issues. Because what I want you to see tonight as we read through and look at this is I want you to see mountain peaks. Because when you look at the future, you see a number of mountain peaks. Now, when you see, for example, a distant peak, and then a peak in the foreground, and another peak still nearer, you can't see the distance of time between them. You can't fill in all that's going to happen between those peaks. You can't tell how separate they are. But you can tell that they're there. Now, here's a peak which is most clearly distinguishable in Luke's Gospel, chapter 21. And he says that you shall be betrayed. This is Luke 21, verse 16. You'll be betrayed. Verse 17, you'll be hated. Verse 18, there shall not a hair of your head perish. Now, that's a puzzling word because it does not mean you won't die or be tortured, because Christians have been tortured, and some of those listening to him were killed by the sword. All right, so that must be interpreted in the light of their spiritual integrity. Their life was preserved, but their body, at least the hair of their heads, was touched. But verse 20, when you shall see Jerusalem compassed with armies, then know that the desolation thereof is near. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of it depart out. Let not them who are in the countries go into Judea or Jerusalem, for these are the days of vengeance, that all things which are written may be fulfilled. But woe to them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days, for there shall be great distress in the land and wrath upon this people. They shall fall by the edge of the sword, and shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. In other words, he's saying there will come a day very soon when Jerusalem will be surrounded by armies, and on that day flee. And of course he's referring to AD 70. This is almost beyond doubt, he's referring to AD 70. Now, turn with me to Matthew's Gospel, chapter 24, and we're going to pick out verses from this chapter. It's just too long. We'd spend all our evening reading. I think it would take us about 20 minutes just to read the whole portion of the two chapters. We're going to read from chapter 24. Now, notice what we've said, that one of the peaks is the fall of Jerusalem. This is one of the peaks. Another of the peaks we'll see Well, it's already included in that because Jesus said, until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So another peak is when Jerusalem is restored to the Jewish nation. Because he said that Jerusalem shall be trodden underfoot of the Gentiles until. And thereby implying that at that point, when the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, then it shall be no longer trodden underfoot of the Gentiles. Anyway, let's turn to chapter 24. You'll find out that I'm not an expert on this subject, and I'm really going to point you to certain of the great points in coming history. Another of the great points in coming history is in chapter 25 and of Matthew, when you can see the judgment seat. All right, we're beginning to point them out. You've got the fall of Jerusalem. We've got the restoration of Jerusalem. We've got the judgment seat of Christ. You're stretching ahead, you can see them coming. Of course, some of them are already behind us. Let's turn then to chapter 24. And this whole subject was brought about by Jesus was being shown, if you like, round the great national heritage, the temple. A very big building complex. Very big. And like our St. Paul's Cathedral, you were probably shown round our great national heritage down there, much of it built on the slave trade, to our everlasting shame. But there you go. It's there. And they showed it off and said, look, isn't it wonderful? And Jesus said, well, yes, not one stone shall be left standing on another. I mentioned to you that when Titus entered into Jerusalem, he gave orders to his troops not to destroy the temple. The fury of the Roman army at what the Jews had been doing and resisting and so on, and the death of their friends, I suppose, or whatever, the fury of the Roman army was such that they destroyed the entire complex and not one stone was left standing on another. Sad, isn't it? And yet it was the Lord's will. We read earlier about it was, he will send his armies and destroy that city. And there it is. Well, here we are. Jesus said, not one stone left standing on another. And as he sat there, the disciples came to him privately saying, tell us, when shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Now, it has been pointed out that they asked three questions. Now, much as I am open to that, the significance of them asking three questions, I'm also a little wary of it, knowing as I do that the disciples are not famed in the scripture for the clarity of their thinking. In other words, they weren't asking three clear questions that they said, well, now we understand that three things are going to happen. They were just talking, and one cannot build too much on it. But nevertheless, note that they asked three questions. When shall these things be? What shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Jesus said, verse 4, take heed that no man deceive you. There'll be false Christs. Verse 6, you'll hear of wars and rumours of war. Be not troubled, for these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. All right, they're not the sign of the end. Nation shall rise against nation, verse 7. Kingdom against kingdom, famines, plagues, diseases, epidemics, earthquakes in diverse places. These are the beginning of birth pangs. Then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted and shall kill you. And you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. Then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. Many false prophets shall rise and shall deceive many. Because iniquity shall abound, the love of the majority of people or of the multitudes shall wax cold. Suggesting in its word that it refers not primarily to the church, but to the multitude in society, and then by influence also the church. That's the Greek word many. He that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved. And here's the real mark of the end: this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness to all nations, and then shall the end come. When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. And in the context of Luke 21, one has to remember that that's exactly his command in the context of the Roman siege of Jerusalem. And he says, well, let him who is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. What it means is he still is to come down, but in the houses of the time, they had to come down on an outside staircase and then go into the house. But he said, no, if you see this happening, come down, but don't bother to go in your house. You understand? That's what he meant by that phrase. Don't turn back to the field, and woe to them that are with child, and pray that your flight be not in the winter, in the cold, nor on the Sabbath day with all the restrictions and hamperings of movement on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of this of the world to this time, no, nor ever shall be. Now, I want you to notice here something that I don't understand, and I'm being very frank with you, I'm not trying to pretend I understand. What I notice here is something that applies, in my understanding, to the fall of Jerusalem. And yet at the same time, I read into it something that is beyond the fall of Jerusalem, which seems to be an event possibly still to come. In other words, that the great tribulation of verse 21 seems to be something greater than just the tribulation in the siege of Jerusalem. Although, in the context of we've read it seems to be applicable to both. You understand what I'm saying? Except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake those days shall be shortened. I got it out. All right. There'll be false Christs. And then verse 27, as the lightning comes out of the east and shines into the west, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Now, I'm not particularly fond of commentators, but I have looked at a number here, and some would even say that that refers to the fall of Jerusalem. I find that really a little stretching the point, but I can't see that. But anyway, you find people say this. I don't believe that. Wherever the carcass is, the dead body, there will the eagles be gathered together. A mysterious word, I take it to mean various things you can interpret that, but I take it simply to mean where there is persecution, there are a lot of cruel spirits gathered to indulge in it, to pick the bones of the carcass, because the word carcass is a dead body. There are a number of words, in fact there are two different words used for the word carcass in the different Gospels, suggesting that he spoke on different occasions like this, and also making it difficult to understand fully what he said. But there you go. Here it means dead body. A corpse. Verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, the moon shall not give her light, the stars shall fall from heaven, the powers of the heavens shall be shaken. Then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. Then shall mourn all the tribes of the earth, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. He shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. They shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. This is the ingathering of his people. Verse 32, learn a parable of the fig tree. We've commented quite in depth on the fig tree in chapter 21, wasn't it? That's right, chapter 21, in the time of judgment of Israel. But here he picks up the parable of the fig tree again and says that it shall yet again put forth leaves. And here's another point on the mountain peaks as he looks forward. We've got the restoration of Jerusalem. We have the restoration of the Jewish state, Israel. So likewise, when you shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled. All right. A generation 40 years from the state of Israel being founded would bring us into the end of the world being in 1988. You missed it. All right. These things fail, don't they? I don't know why. But anyway, there you go. Mysterious words, who can work them out? All right, then there'll be of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. As the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. Eating, drinking, marrying, giving in marriage. And the flood came and took them away. Then shall two be in the field, the one shall be taken in judgment, carried away by the flood. The other left. Two women shall be grinding at the mill, the one shall be taken away in the judgment, the other left. Watch therefore, for you know not what hour your Lord doth come. And we come back to the word we considered earlier in this day, would. But know this, verse 43, that if the goodman of the house had known in what watch the thief would come, he would have watched. And would not have suffered his house to be broken up. Therefore be you also ready, for in such an hour as you think not, the Son of Man cometh. Who then is a faithful and wise steward, servant, whom his Lord hath made ruler over his household, to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his Lord, when he comes, shall find so doing, he shall make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant shall say in his heart, my Lord delays his coming, and shall begin to smite his fellow servants, and to eat and drink with the drunken, the Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looks not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. All right, well, let's look at this chapter a little bit then. Now, the point is that he's standing in a certain day at a certain time. And he is one of the things he's prophesying, as we've already seen, is the dispersal of the Jews for the majority of this our age. He's prophesying the fall of Jerusalem, particularly we've seen that in Luke. He seems to be prophesying, and I think this is what it refers to in verse 6, wars and rumours of wars, that he's really prophesying the end of what you could call the Pax Romana. Because at the time that Christ came, the world was held in a great peace, because there was one superpower, there weren't two. And wherever there was a rebellion, it was put down. And there was a great peace over the world by the Pax Romana. I'm not a historian, I can't comment on it. But that ended, you see. It came to an end. And Jesus said it will end. But he said that is not the sign of the end. I suppose we could say we've had many years like this. We've had years of nation rising against nation and so on, and famines and plagues and so on, and they've gone on throughout the centuries. I don't know how many years in the history of the world that we know of have been without a war, but there aren't many. I don't know how many years of the 20th century have been without a war, but probably none. All right, so here it is. These are the beginnings of the birth pangs. The point about birth pangs is that when they actually come, they are immediately heightened till there is a sudden rush in the birth of the child. All right, now let's just look at this first great mountain peak, which is in verse 16, which we can see in this respect. Then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains. Now it seems to be a historical fact that in the fall of Jerusalem, no Christians died, because the Christians fled and lived over Jordan, and moved, a great number of them moved to a city called Pella in AD 67. I've written it down in my margin, Pella, because I'd forget it. And there it is, let them which are in Judea flee into the mountains. And there you have this mountain peak. But you notice already that we've got a mixture in what he's saying. Look what we've got there, verse 13, he that shall endure to the end, the same shall be saved, and the gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness to all nations, and then shall the end come. And there you've got, as if in the first 14 verses, he has bridged this gap. He's looked immediately through, he's seen right through to the very end of the age when he says, then shall the end come. And now it seems as if he's going back to another mountain peak, that when you see this in Judea, flee. Do you see what I'm saying? So as you read down this chapter, and you can do it again on your own, identify peaks and then attach different verses to different peaks. If you want to try and make a logical progression through the chapter, you may find yourself snared or tripped up on the way. But notice that verse 14, that the real sign of the end there in verse 14 is that the gospel is preached. In other words, it is not when somebody pulls a nuclear trigger. It doesn't lie in the hands of Bill Clinton. And it doesn't lie in the hands of President Yeltsin or Zhirinovsky, or worse things. It lies in the hands of God. God says, I will let my gospel be preached. And when I am satisfied it is preached to all nations, then shall the end come. This is a puzzling thing. We can't fully understand it. And we do ourselves injustice when we try and guess what that means, that the gospel should be preached to all nations. I've heard it said that now the gospel is preached on the airways, and therefore it is already preached into all nations by radio. Personally, I do not believe that is the fulfillment of this word. I believe that the fulfillment of this word refers to a move of God's Spirit that touches every nation, not a gospel portion on radio waves, not a translation of the gospel in every language, but the actual moving of God's Spirit among all the nations of the world. I may have mentioned to you, I'll mention it again, that Hudson Taylor, I'm not sure of the year, 1855, where I read it, I'm not sure if that's accurate, but 1855, he was on furlough and had a vision. While he was preaching, he was interrupted by the Lord while he was preaching, and he gave this vision of what he'd seen, and he saw two great wars coming over the world, which were one war. And then he said, which is fulfilled in the First and Second World Wars, because they were one war. And then he said, I see an awakening in Russia, which will be greater than any awakening before it, and it shall spread all over Europe, and from Russia. And he said, then I see another great awakening, greater still, over all the world before the return of Christ. All right? That's the words of Hudson Taylor. Very wonderful, but how would you know it happened? It'll be on the Daily Express? No, I don't think it will. But whatever it is, here's the truth, that when that happens, that's the end. I'm not saying that Hudson Taylor was infallibly correct, but what I'm saying is this is the end, when the gospel is preached in power to all the nations, then shall the end come. And then you've got this verse 15, when you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation. This is fulfilled at different points in history. For example, no one who is familiar with history would doubt that this was fulfilled, I've forgotten the exact date, in about, I think it was 300 and something BC, with a man called Antiochus Epiphanes, who attacked Jerusalem whatever he did, he sacrificed pigs on the altar in the temple in Jerusalem. And this caused such a great outcry of horror among the Maccabean priesthood that there was a great heroic defense. And it's described in the book of Maccabees, one of the few books worth reading in the Apocrypha, which has got some historical value as historical documents. Now that is historical fact, that this was fulfilled before Christ spoke. And the time of the period of the time in which that took place was also a similar period of time that fits in with other periods of time that you read in the in various passages of Scripture, being about 42 months and so on. You can find these things. But the point is that it was fulfilled again in AD 70 when the Roman insignia was raised over the temple. It was fulfilled, I don't know the date of this, somebody here may know the date of this, it was fulfilled and is still in its fulfillment to this day when the Mohammedans built a mosque on the Dome of the Rock, on the temple site, to the false prophet who denied that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. And written, inscribed on the Dome of the Rock today is the text, not the text, I don't know whether it's a text from the Quran or what, but it says that God has no son. Muhammad, there's one God, Allah, his prophet is Muhammad, and God has no son. It's written there on the site of the Holy of Holies. I don't know when that was established, but it's been there a long time. You understand, these things are a mystery. Some believe that there'll be a temple rebuilt and various things. I honestly cannot see it. If it happened tomorrow, of course, I'd probably say, well, I'm sorry, I was wrong. People talk of a temple being prepared in America and people practicing worship. I am certain of this, that God has no desire for a return to Old Testament sacrifice of animals. I'm certain of it. Whether the Jewish nation would like to return to it is another question. I have no doubt they want to, but God doesn't. But the point is, this prophecy here has already had fulfillment at various moments in history. You could say, well, we're looking for it to come in a greater way or a more horrific way. Another way in which it could come, or has come, is the way in which the Pope has become has set himself up as God in the Roman Catholic Church. Now there's a sense in which the Church has become overtaken by a man who sits in the temple of God declaring that he is God. One of the titles of the Pope is the Most High God, dating from about the 8th century AD. Another thing that it was made, conferred upon the Pope about 100 years ago, it was not long ago, 100 years ago, it was conferred upon the Pope that he was infallible. equal to God in that respect. Infallible. And of course, we do know that he sits in what is, whether we regard it as a church or not, the world has forced to recognize that the greatest representative of Christianity as a religion in the world is the Roman Catholic Church, which no one can doubt is an antichrist force in the world. The interesting thing is that the word antichrist in the Greek is itself a phrase which does not mean against Christ, like our English word, which is derived from a Greek word, anti, against. But that is not the word the meaning of the original Greek. The word antichrist, it means instead of Christ, not against Christ. There are many antichrists instead of Christs. The interesting thing about this is that one of the main titles of the Pope is the Vicarius Filii Dei, which means, translated into Greek, antichrist. God's representative on the earth, appearing in the place of Christ. The other interesting thing about it is that when you add up the numbers of Vicarius Filii Dei, which are number values in Roman, and you have to check this out very carefully, because the Roman numeral system when John was writing was different to a later one. You have to do it with John's, not a later one. I've forgotten which letter was they changed, but there's a letter they changed later in its value. According to the number system that was there in John's day, Vicarius Filii Dei, when numbered together, this is not in dispute, it's very simple, and you can work it out very easily, comes to 666. That's simply a fact. That's his chief title. These are little facts. But the point is that, you see, when we think of things, oh, this is going to be fulfilled. Look at the mountain peaks as they presented to you. When the Christians lived in the Dark Ages, when there was no Reformation, and the Roman Catholic Church put to death anybody who practiced baptism by immersion. Or took communion outside of the Roman Catholic Church. This was before the Reformation. After the Reformation, you had two great Protestant movement and a Catholic movement. Don't think the Protestant movement was better than the Catholic. The Protestant states of Germany were not made Protestant by conversion. They were made Protestant by political choice, just as our nation was. Our nation is politically Protestant. I'm not saying I don't praise God for that. I believe it's probably done us more good than we know. But the head of the Church of England was Henry VIII. All right. I don't know why they've got problems with Charles being divorced. Of course, we want to go back to the great days of Britain, when our kings beheaded their wives. Our perspective on history is always a little bit odd. When we think of going back in history to the better days, we refer to the golden era that never existed. Of course, there was a golden era. Britain is just coming out of it. The highest point of our national history is the Second World War. And we'll live in the shadow of that great moment, and in the glory of it, and in the pride of it. But it won't do us any good. Not spiritually. You understand? Anyway, we're going off subject a bit. But the thing is that in the time of the Middle Ages, when the Roman church was there, it was there. They were killing Christians. They reckon 70 million Christians died at the hands of the Roman Catholic Church. 70 million. tortured horribly. Wives drowned. If the husband was a practicer of baptism, baptized people, the wives were drowned. The husband burnt. That was regarded universally by Christians as being the Antichrist and an abomination of desolation in the house of God. All right, you could say it's been fulfilled. All right, now the point I'm making is that when you look at a thing, you can't always see what's happening. Now, if things get worse, and now we see perhaps for example, another horror coming up. Well, I'll tell you another horror that I see that's in our day. I see it actually before our eyes. I see in our mainstream churches, and I'm talking about evangelical movement that we respect and look to, I'm seeing men standing up with strange powers and taking center stage, and they've moved Christ off. There was an article recently by Clifford Hill, who was at a certain meeting, and the thing that he most lamented in the meeting that he describes, where this man was obviously manipulating things and controlling things, was that no one was allowed to move in a spontaneous prayer. He controlled the whole thing. This man controlled the whole thing, controlled it from the front. The strange thing is that this grand delusion seems to be swallowing up church after church after church, which we would say is not a Catholic church, it's not a church, it's what we say is believers. And I would say in the West there seems to be a groundswell building up for a manifestation of something that is against and in the stead of Christ, right in the middle of so-called Christian churches. Anyway, these are just things that you observe. What you've got to be aware of is when you look at this chapter, you've got to be aware of the feeling that when the end comes, there's going to be a headline in the Times saying, stupendous crisis touches the world, tribulation such as has never been seen, Christ about to return. You won't see that. There might be a media blackout on it. You know, I don't know if people realize, but there was a time, it's certainly true today to this day in some degree, but you remember that the freedom of the press to report what is happening in the world is something that is limited to Britain, North America, certain European countries, and because of the strength of those countries, the Western nations, the G7 as they're called, other nations have to fall in line with it. Once the economic power of the world is no longer in defense of an open display of truth, the night goes out on the world. There's no truth broadcast anywhere anymore. You wouldn't know what was happening in the world. People in Russia lived in profound ignorance for years and years of what was happening in other parts of the world. China, the same. You know, when Stalin died, the great difficulty was how to let the news come out. All right, so what we've got is this fact. Let's look on another fact, this verse 21. Let's look at this great tribulation. It seems to be held by many that tribulation is going to come after. I have a friend who told me that the tribulation will definitely come after the rapture. And he told me that the majority of Revelation is written for people after the rapture. It's describing what we'll miss. Now, I've never seen a shred of evidence for that in the Bible. Although I've seen many arguments for it. The point is that the Great Tribulation is a tribulation against the church. It's taken place in history by the Catholic Church. It's taken place in Russia against the church. It's taken place in China to stamp out the church. The one great enemy for the whole world system seems to be the church. It's been attacked in this country in more subtle ways. The venom of British mind is more subtle, and thereby more effective, more plausible. If you put a gun to somebody's head and said, "You must not believe in Christ," that's not a very clever argument. It carries a lot of weight. But if somebody laughs at you when you say you believe in God, and it's forbidden to teach such things, and all the universities that teach on the Bible prove that the Bible is wrong anyway. Anyway, this is it, verse 21. I'm just pointing out to you various dimensions of this chapter. Great tribulation. Is it going to come to this country? Could we escape it? Who knows? We believe that things are going to be on a nation, on an international scale. I have no doubt in my mind that that is what the inevitable course of history is, for ever greater unions of nations. This is why Christians have a special insight into things like the common market. There is no doubt that the common market, whether or not it is the Antichrist, is definitely a force for Antichrist. It will be used for wickedness. That's why Christians have an insight into these things. All the confederations of the world, all the unifying of the world which is happening, is going to end up in the end to be used for evil. And so we have this great tribulation. Then it says in verse 29, after the tribulation, then shall the Son of Man come. And all the tribes of the earth shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. He shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet and gather them together. It is a fact that another of the great facts, looking again, we've seen the dispersal of Israel through the nations. We've seen abomination of desolation somewhere in history, possibly at different points. We've seen the re-establishment of Israel. We've seen the Jerusalem again come back to the Jews. We can see now that one day the sign of the Son of Man is going to appear in the heavens, and he shall return. And one of the events then will be that he shall gather us together. When will that be? You come to the conclusion as you look at the book, it could be tonight. You can interpret Scripture in different ways, but you can interpret it that it's tonight. And as I said, if you're right or wrong, in the end somebody's going to be right. And he shall come. And when he comes, he'll gather us all together in the air. But here we've got to mention again, verse 30-32, we've mentioned this, a parable of the fig tree. And Luke mentions not only this tree, but also all the trees putting forth their tender branches and so on. And, you have this sense throughout all the world of a move throughout all the nations. Every nation is experiencing some stirring, some different. I suppose it's partly to do with the speed of change in our age. The fact that what took place over many, many years, there were many years where there was little change. Now everything is so rapid. Right, let's move on again. And I just want to point out now verse 36, so that day and hour knoweth no man. No, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. And there's this element you find coming in here. is that, well, people may claim to know, people may have their insight, expert insight and say they know this and that. They don't know. In the end, you can look at the signs, and the signs are so written that you can see some things. You can see this and this and this, but all you can see from it is that, yes, it must be very close. It must be very close indeed. Now, why? Why does he tell us? Well, if you were in a prison in Russia, being beaten, and we've read the stories, if you were in China, whatever it was, the point is that these things comfort you. They comfort you. If you're sitting in a comfortable armchair in Britain with a nice cup of tea and a cozy fire, they fascinate you. But he didn't write them to fascinate you. He wrote it for the comfort. He said, comfort one another with these words. That's what Paul said. Comfort one another. Because they were going through tribulation. You find it in the day when Rome was lighting up the streets with Christians tarred and lit as human torches. As Nero blamed the Christians for the problems of his empire. And at his great parties, he had human torches tarred and burning in his gardens through Rome. The Christians had to flee and hide. Comfort one another with these words. The days of the great persecution, for 300 years the Roman Empire, with all its might, sought to devastate the Christian church. Anybody who did not offer a pinch of this incense to Caesar was killed, because he was God. Christians wouldn't accept it. And later on, when the Roman church took that over, you've got this move through history. Comfort one another with these words. Why is these truths given? It's so that when Christians are going through it, they may hear this word, comfort. He's coming back. When? Well, if you were in 300 AD and you were being martyred, or you were in prison or whatever it was, all you would know is it's coming soon. He's coming. It's the understanding that the final denouement of our age is not that man will rule till the end. It's Christ will intervene in our history. He's going to intervene. But this is what he points out, and this is the other side of it. This is chapter 24 again. And this is the great word that comes through as he teaches on this. This is what he concludes in. This is his great word, watch. We've done a sort of a brief scan of things, but here it is. This is the word, watch. Now you see, wakefulness is the point. Spiritual wakefulness. It says in verse 42, you do not know what hour your Lord doth come. He may come before you die. But all you know is that you must never at any point assume that you have 10 years in which you can sort of relax and sort of indulge. What does all this imply anyway? If a person relaxes and does what they want, it implies that in their hearts they've begun to live in this world, not for the next. The point of this truth that he's coming back is that it's the truth that this world is but a forecourt for the next. Here's the great need. Watch. Verse 44. Be you also ready. Verse 43 says, again, this word would. If you had known what hour the thief would come, you would have watched. You would watch. You would not allow the devil to devastate the church. You wouldn't allow things to go so wrong. In your estimation of the order of God in your home, Because here, this is the thing. You are watchman over what? Are you watchman over yourself? Yes, yourself. Watchman over your family? Yes, your family. Watchman over your church. I have set watchmen on the walls of Jerusalem. You are watchman. What does a watchman do? He has to be faithful and wise. Verse 44, be you also ready, for in such an hour as you think not, he's coming. He's coming, and he will come when you don't think. Paul said that you are not as them that sleep in the asleep in the night and are drunken, that day should overtake you unawares. But you notice what he said, you are not of those that sleep and are drunken. That's the vital thing, because if you're asleep and drunken, it shall overtake you unawares. It isn't only the day of the Lord in his return, it's the day of the Lord in the day he comes for me. One day, Christ will come to this world for me, individually. If he does not come for the world as a whole, he will still come for me individually. He's going to come for you. He's going to come for you one day. The whole point about it is that Christians live settled in this world as if this was it. You have to live on the edge of your seat looking for his return. And then he says, verse 48, if that evil servant shall say in his heart, oh, my Lord delays his coming, begins to virtually live like all the world. I've pointed it out again and again. The truth is that in the history of the world, the church has never been overcome by outside persecution. The only thing that's overcome the church is worldliness. This happened in Constantine's day. As soon as it was an established religion, almost within a decade, the tone of the church had changed to being worldly. The only thing that overcomes you is wilderness. If you're like a Trojan horse, it gets in because it's acceptable. And so he ends with this very grave warning. The Lord of that servant shall come in a day when he looks not for him, and in an hour that he is not aware of, and shall cut him asunder, and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. And here you've got this, there's the fascination. But how many miss this? What are you? How are you ready? Spiritually alert, aware of God. In what atmosphere? Holiness and ready with garments white. Watching unto prayer, longing for his return. Observing the signs of the times, humbly, with eagerness. And yet knowing it could be now. That's only the midpoint of his talk. We'll come to the second half of his talk in a moment. Let's just pray.